We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Listeners, we have a fun and informative adult improver interview coming your way with National Master Jordan Groff. But I needed to record an intro to the intro because I forgot to make an exciting announcement when I was recording with Jordan. And that announcement is that I will be playing in and attending the National Open in Las Vegas, June 5th to 9th, 2024. Some of you may have heard I interviewed some players from that tournament last year. If you check for a bonus pod in June of 2023, you can hear players chronicling this chess festival. It's part of the Las Vegas International Chess Festival. It's a tournament I've wanted to go to for a really long time, so I'm glad to have the opportunity. They always get all kinds of chess celebs there, like Ben Feingold and the Botez sisters were there last year. This year's guests are still to be announced, but I'm sure it will have a fun cast of chess celebs, and it's just a big event with lots of fun activities to play in. Again, I will be doing some of the activities or participating in some myself. The details are still TBA, but we did wanted to let you all know in case anyone is on the fence about going or thinking of clearing their calendar. Hopefully this gives you some added incentive to come out and say hi. I'm super excited to play in the National Open and to talk to and hang out with a bunch of chess players. So again, June 5th to 9th, Las Vegas. I'll put the link in the show description. You can email me if you have any questions about that or anything else, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get you to the interview with Jordan Groff. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Adult Improver edition of Perpetual Chess. This, of course, is where we interview an amateur player about their enthusiasm for chess. They share some improvement tips and reflect on their own chess journeys. Although our guest today is a pretty strong player. He's bordering on semi-pro between his work as a chess trainer and a player. And we will get into that momentarily. But first, I wanted to give some thanks, first of all, to Perpetual Chess Patreon subs. Thank you all so much for helping to keep the podcast going. Of course, Patreon members can find out who the guests are in advance, submit questions for them, attend special events such as Grandmaster Zoom lectures, and get access to ad-free podcasts. I also wanted to thank our sponsor, Chessable.com. As I record this on March 18th, I believe this will be out in early April. And you know what else will be out in early April? Courses by Grandmaster Peter Lecoe. Grandmaster Maurice Ashley's got a new one coming out. Whatever opening it is you're interested in, obviously, Chessable is my go-to for opening research and learning. So be sure to make it a part of your routine to check out all of their new offerings. And if you join Chessable Pro, you get a discount on subsequent courses. And if you use the link that I will graciously put in the Perpetual Chess description, then you will be helping to support the pod. As for this week's guest on the pod, so as I mentioned, he is a Connecticut-based chess instructor, 24 years of age. He was actually suggested to me as a guest by his coach, friend of the pod, Grandmaster Eugene Perelstein, because Eugene, of course, sees a lot of chess students come down the pike and noted that our guest has made unusual progress in the past few years. Since 2018, he's gone from 1,800 to nearly 2,300 USCF. Amazing progress. Now, he is a fairly young man, which maybe helps him in this endeavor, but nonetheless, excited to hear what it takes to make master here in 2024. I know it's not as easy as it used to be, and I'm excited to dig in and welcome Jordan Groff to the pod. Welcome, Jordan.
Hi, thank you. It's very nice to be on the podcast. I have been listening for the last few years, so it's nice to meet you.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to chat and excited to dig in. So Jordan, you got back into chess around 2018 after some time away in your sort of formative years, presumably. I haven't done the math, but maybe you got back into it in university. Is that right?
Yeah, high school, actually. I would say my junior and senior year of high school, I was getting back into it. But yeah, I didn't really play any tournaments until starting around 2018. I think I was already graduated from high school. I played like one tournament that summer, and then I started playing a little bit when I was in college. But yeah, it really took me a while to get back into it.
So when you went away, what happened? And when you came back, what happened?
I guess I'll just start at the beginning. So I used to play. I lived in Arizona as a kid, and I used to play in a bunch of their scholastic tournaments there. I was in like my elementary school chess club, and that would have been like 2008 or 2009. I was born in 2000, so I was like 8 or 9 years old. But then after that, and unfortunately, actually, those tournaments, they weren't USCF rated. And so there's really like no record of them that I've been able to find. I think that I would estimate I was probably around like 1,000 strength. I vaguely remember like my rating in their like private system was like just over 1,000, I think, when we moved and I stopped playing. But then we moved here and I didn't have that same familiar structure that I was used to. And I sort of fell off chess for a while. And I played like literally 3 or 4 tournaments between like 2009 and 2018 when I came back. So it was very unfortunate. I actually often regret, that I didn't stick with it during those years because I feel like I could have probably made a lot of progress. But it is what it is. And now I'm just trying to improve, as it happened.
So yeah. So what year was it what age years were you playing when you were in Arizona?
I would have been like, I think 7, 8, and 9, I think.
Okay. And then you resumed in Connecticut at age 16?
Pretty much. Yeah. I would say I think when I was 16 or 17, I kind of was getting back into it and I was starting to, play a lot of chess online and watch a lot of, chess content on YouTube and stuff like that. And I started getting a lot better than I ever was before, because really, I think before, like I played a lot as a kid, but I didn't really know too much. Like I didn't really know any openings at all. I didn't really know any real like deep strategy. I mean, it was very like rudimentary what I actually knew.
And do you remember what specifically, like you say you watched a lot of videos, but do you remember what specifically sucked you back in? Like, was it one event or? More gradual thing.
I guess it was probably just a more gradual thing. Like I was interested in some other video games, I think, when I was in middle school and high school. But I guess when I came back, when I sort of rediscovered chess, I was just like, well, this game is sort of just better than all those other ones.
Nice.
Because, there's no... there's really very limited, chance or luck. It's pretty much just like, it's up to you and your opponent, what happens on the board. And so I always liked that kind of purity about chess.
Yeah, it's timeless. And as people, I can't remember if it was Danny Ranch or Eric Albest, but one of them in one of their interviews about chess.com, they pointed out that even for gamers, the main difference between chess and video games is it's the identical game, whether you play it like in person, you know, or virtually, you know, or on a video, on a screen. Whereas there's really no other game you can say that about, whether it be like a sport where you're playing a video game or a video game that you can't really mimic in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, it's the best.
Yeah.
So when you came back, at what point did you like go back to a tournament?
That was like summer of 2018. I played in this Fairfield Chess Club. If anybody knows the area, Fairfield Chess Club, like their club championship, I think it was, or something. That was pretty interesting. I think I was playing in like, they had a master section, which I obviously wasn't playing in. I think my rating was like, 1300 provisional or something at that point. I think I remember it was a pretty good tournament for me. I don't remember exactly like who I played, but I do remember there were already like a couple faces who I knew. Like I think GM Alex Fishbein was actually playing there that year.
Oh, cool.
Also GM Lenderman also.
Nice.
Was
friends
there.
Of the pod both. Yeah.
And so like I was just getting into it. This was like my first tournament back. And then I saw these people who like I recognized them, and I knew that that was kind of a cool experience. But yeah.
And then were you like studying again right away? At what point did you decide to devote serious time to it?
Yeah, I was definitely already studying quite a bit, I think. Mostly that involved just like playing a lot of rapid games online. I think that was the main thing I was doing. And also I loved watching like some content on YouTube where like you know, a strong player playing rapid games live was always something that I sought out. Like I remember at the beginning, I was watching a lot of like the Ginger GM videos. He was doing a lot of those rapid games at that time. I think he still does. I think Chess Network also, he was doing a lot. Found that to be like pretty inspiring, just because, you know, I would play the rapid games and then I would be like, you know, kind of getting angry or whatever, and like having all these like additional thoughts, and then I would watch them and it's like, it's so logical. Like it's the process of how they come up with their moves, right? It's like, they explain it, you can understand what they're doing. And that always just kind of inspired me to just work on my like mentality. And also I learned a lot from watching the videos as well. So
I feel like it takes a bit of patience to watch someone live, because you can watch them recap it and they synthesize their thoughts, which is maybe not as pure, but it's also more time efficient. Did you find it hard if you're sitting there watching someone play one game for half an hour? Did you find your attention flagging at all?
No, not really. I think I always just thought those types of videos were super interesting. I don't really remember getting bored by it so much.
And Jordan, so you mentioned you played some video games. You know, I'm old, so forgive me if I say anything wrong. But my understanding of video game culture, it's very common as a way to get better to obviously watch Twitch streamers. And in that regard, like if you're watching someone play, you know, whatever the, you know, game du jour is, I'll probably, you know, World of Warcraft or whatever it might be. I'm sure I'm using super outdated references. But it's normal to watch them play live and have that be how you learn. Was that part of the reason that you gravitated towards that, or were you only like sort of into video games?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess I would say I was only sort of into it. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I definitely was like already sort of watching some Twitch streams, but I wouldn't really say that had much to do with why I sort of was attracted to that kind of content.
Okay. So you're watching a lot of videos and playing a ton online, excuse me. And how often would you say you were playing OTB as you got back into it?
I would say probably once a month or once every other month at first. I mean, it was a little bit difficult to find time because I was in college then, and definitely like my first year or two of college, I was thinking like, you know, I don't want to get so sucked into chess, right? That that it kind of takes up everything. Like I wanted to prioritize school, I would say. But yeah, I luckily met up with the other chess players at our college, which was a very small college, but somehow we ended up having a lot of chess players there. And I met them pretty early on, and we would go to tournaments together. And that was like, that was during my freshman year. And I was definitely really grateful for that. Cause they nice. Definitely kind of helped me really get into it. So.
And did you go to college in Connecticut?
I did. Yeah. I went to Connecticut College, which is a very small liberal arts college in New London, Connecticut.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. You're fortunate to have some chess players there. It's like what, 3,000 kids or something like that?
Less than that. Yeah. It's actually like, I don't know, 1,700 or 1,800
okay.
kids.
Yeah. I went to Pomona, another small liberal arts school. And yeah, the size was identical and it definitely feels small.
Yeah. No, it was incredible. We always had like four or five like pretty strong chess players like throughout the whole time I was there, which is pretty ridiculous, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's very, those little lucky. Yeah, they make a huge difference over time. So you mentioned in an email to me that you have a particular affinity for openings. Was that the case from like right when you came back, or did that come in as you sort of got better?
I would say, yeah, it kind of was almost right when I came back. Probably there was a little bit of time before I really discovered, you know, how to study openings. But yeah, it was pretty early on. I remember the first openings, like the first time I really started studying openings, I think was I bought this course from Simon Williams, the killer D4, I think it was called. I don't play anything in there nowadays, but I just remember like going through it, and it was like, this was like before Chessable, I guess. So I would just like, it was like a video course, and I would just watch all the chapters, and I would, I had the idea somehow to like put them into a Lee Chess study. And ever since then, I've used Lee Chess studies for my openings. I think it's like super convenient and easy. Yeah, but anyway, yeah, I would say that it's useful if you're not sure how to begin studying openings. I would say that it's useful to get a course, I think. Or if you have some kind of like coach, I think then, you know, they can kind of show you what to study, what's going to be useful, and how to learn.
And Eugene mentioned that you switched openings at some points.
Yeah, I've switched openings quite a bit, I would say, with both colors, which is actually kind of intentional. I think it's a good idea to switch openings every once in a while because it just keeps the game fresh, I think. I think, you know, there's one school of thought that says like you should just play one opening, and you know, you have one repertoire for white, one repertoire for black, and you just play that for your entire life. You become like an expert in it. But I personally find that to be kind of like, you know, boring. Like usually I play an opening for a while, and then I just want to kind of switch because it gets a bit stale. And I also think that it's helpful to improve if you're kind of, if you switch openings and because then you get exposed to all different sorts of positions. And I think it really helps you grow as a player. And even if when you're picking up a new opening, there's like, you know, you don't know all the theory, right? That, I think in some ways that can actually be kind of interesting. I've definitely had the experience where I'm playing a game, I don't know the theory or something in this new opening that I'm playing. And, you know, even sometimes if I don't play like the theoretical move, sometimes I actually feel like it kind of, it's not really a huge disadvantage because I'm kind of you know, posing my own problems to my opponent, right? Which, like, if I played the theory move, then like they might still know what to do, but like, you know, I play this other move that that I don't know and they don't know, and okay, now I'm, you know, now we're just playing on our own, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And let me ask you, Jordan, you mentioned that you switched openings a bunch, but when you switch, do you tend to stick with that opening? I'm particularly curious, like, you know, everyone's always concerned about being prepped for and stuff like that. So are, do you feel like when you sit down at the board, you might play three openings, or is it like right now I'm in an E4 phase or whatever, and I'm playing E4? Which would you say?
I would say for the most part, I sort of go through like these phases, like you were saying, like yeah, discrete. usually. I will like have a repertoire that I know I'm going to play at any given time. Recently I've sort of started to branch out from that a bit. I would say like I feel comfortable playing different openings, like potentially in the same tournament. But yeah, for the most part, it's been like a phase where like, I just want to play this one opening, gain as much experience as possible as I can with it. And the next, you know, however long I'm going to be playing it, like maybe a year. And then, yeah, just go from there. Right.
And do you feel like people are prepped for you? Like,
I mean, it depends. I mean, sometimes I'm sure they are, but I think I'm kind of difficult to prepare for, and I like to keep it that way. I don't have too many games in the database, which is helpful. And I mostly play on, when I play online, mostly I play on like an anonymous account. I mean, I have some public accounts, but I usually don't play like whatever my current repertoire is on those.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Nate Solon has written about this. It's super tricky because, like, for example, if you're playing Titled Tuesday, you know, like for, you know, a lowly master like me, yeah, and you, at least for now, you know, you want to play your best stuff. You know, you want to be able to get better at those specific things. But on the other hand, then you're, you know, that ends up in the chess-based database, you know, in addition to like your name being linked to the chess.com account. So it's kind of a catch-22. Nate, in a recent column, advised to have a slightly wider repertoire, where like, okay, maybe you can't play everything under the sun, but you know, you've got a few openings for each side that are public, but at least they don't know like exactly which one you're going to play. So I'm kind of moving in that direction, but it's a constant dilemma for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I have to say, I haven't actually tried to play Titled Tuesday yet. Oh, okay. I'm sure I will at some point, but I've been sort of sitting that out, both because of the opening dilemma, but also just because like, I don't know, I teach lessons on Tuesdays, and sometimes those are kind of interfering with it.
It's fine.
I will try it at some point, but
yeah, you definitely should at some point, but you do have to give some thought to like, how am I going to approach this with my openings? And have you been doing along the way, like, I mean, it sounds like you're competing frequently. You're getting lessons with Eugene periodically, which we'll get to. A lot of work on openings. But have you done like discrete tactics work? Has that been a part of your regimen, or is it just like kind of learn from playing?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've definitely made a big effort to work on tactics. Like, I guess my favorite way to work on tactics is chess.com puzzles, and also chess.com, like the Puzzle Rush survival mode, okay, I think is very useful. I think Lee Chess tactics are really just as good. For some reason, I prefer chess.com puzzles. Like, they seem somehow more like satisfying. I don't know exactly why. Sometimes with the Lee Chess puzzles, I feel like, you know, you get some position and it's like, well, you know, this like 1700 Lee Chess just blundered a piece. Cause you know how they just pick it from the real games, which is mostly good, but sometimes it ends up in some kind of weird tactics puzzles. I've worked on tactics a lot. Actually, I also want to say, I felt like, you know, getting into it, I remember when I was getting back into tournament chess, I was actually worried at first that my tactics were kind of worse than others around my rating level. And I was kind of worried that that was going to be something that like that stuck with me because I hadn't played. I had played as a kid, which I think gave me a very, very good foundation. Even though I wasn't a very strong player back then, I think that like having that chess foundation in me, it was almost like it was like this, it made it so that it wasn't quite like learning a second language. I do think that definitely helped me. But yeah, I was worried at first that my tactics were going to be worse. And so I did train a lot of tactics for sure. Yeah. And I don't think that that's really the case anymore. Like I don't actually feel like I feel like I've caught up to the players around my level. So
yeah, and I just want to underscore the point you made about it being sort of still a native language, because I know we have a lot of adult learners who many of whom came to chess as adults. So Jordan obviously has had unusual success, but I appreciate, and I think listeners definitely should note that the fact that you'd laid that foundation in those early years, I do think, as I've said before and written about, like language is a really useful corollary. So if you imagine two kids where, you know, one lives in Spain for, you know, between the ages of 7 and 9, and then lives somewhere where he doesn't speak Spanish for 10 years, and the other never lives in Spain and maybe took a few classes when they were between 7 and 9 or something, like obviously the gulf is vast. You know, the difference is huge of just having laid that foundation. Obviously, that doesn't discredit all the work and progress you've made, but I know there's other people who might find it more challenging at different phases of life. So you're doing a lot of openings. You're studying a lot of tactics, maybe 3 years ago, but maybe less so now. And you mentioned in an email that chess has been basically, it's your life right now because you're a chess trainer and you're competing frequently. And I know for people in that situation, it can be kind of hard to separate work, you know, business from pleasure in terms of like how much time you spend on chess. But what would you estimate in terms of your actual like chess that's for you? How much would you say you're doing per day or per week?
Hard to say. I mean, I definitely am not as like disciplined about it as I probably should be. So I think that like by that I mean like I spend a lot of time like playing sort of meaningless blitz games that doesn't actually help me improve.
Do you review them or not really?
When my mental state is good, then I'm reviewing my blitz games.
Right.
but sometimes, you know, I can't say that it's always like that. But yeah, I guess to give an answer to the question, probably I would say I probably have like 4 hours, I would say, of like study time most days.
That's a ton. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so that could be like that could be like studying openings, reading some book, or also like, yeah, if I am in like a, like if I am playing like somewhat serious blitz or rapid games online, I would also include that and then like reviewing them. I would say, yeah, somewhere between, yeah, probably 2 to 4 hours a day.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a big part of your success too, I'm sure. We'll be right back with more Chess Improvement Talk with National Master Jordan Groff. And we are back. Eugene highlighted that he thought one of the reasons that you've made progress, so much progress, is your willingness to play challenging opponents. He said that he encouraged you to play tougher competition, to play up, as we call it, when you play in open tournaments. Did that take convincing for you or not really?
Not really, no. I remember one of the first lessons I had with him, maybe it was even the first one. I don't remember if it was like after this like World Open in 2022, I want to say it was. And I played in the under 2200 section, and I think I asked him like, you know, should I be playing? My rating was like around 2000 or 2100 at that point. And I asked him at some point, like, you know, should I be playing in the under 2200 section and maybe try to win it? Or should I play in the open section? He said, you should always play in the open section if you can. And I pretty much never looked back from that point. Yeah, and even before then also, though, I have to say, I was always trying to play up, like, even when my rating was, let's say, like 1700, I would always try to play in like the under 2000 or under 2100 section, which I think is pretty important if you want to improve, because I think it's, you know, it is very important to play players who are stronger than you, because you're not going to be able to like rely on sort of cheap tricks, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to actually try to find the best moves, which is at the end of the day, I think, what it's all about. So, yeah.
Yeah. One thing I just want to add. Now, actually, next time I get a chance to interview Eugene, I'll have to ask him about this, because I don't know what his opinion is. But I've mentioned before that mine is that, yes, you should always play up. But I generally advise playing up just one section, which is what you were doing if you're rated 2000 and playing an open. And the only reason I point that out is because I've seen like 1500 players who are told to play up and then they play in the open section. But then they either end up getting like smacked down so hard that they might end up getting full point buys and being frustrated by that. Or like there's a bunch of other 1500s who've been told to play up playing in the open section. So it's like some combination of the two things. Whereas if you just play up one section, you have a better chance of picking off at minimum half points here and there and just sort of like being in the general, you know, grouping of players where you're playing tougher competition, but not impossible competition. I don't know if you have an opinion on that, Jordan.
No, actually, I completely agree. I would also add that. Yeah, playing up doesn't mean like you're like you said, 1500 playing in the open section. It's like, I think it's best if you're playing people who are between like 100 and maybe 400 points higher rated than you. I think that's probably like those are probably the opponents that you can learn the most from.
Yeah. And of course, there are exceptions like the Reykjavik Open's going on right now, the US Open every summer in the United States. Like those are designed to be giant open tournaments. And those, like, obviously, there's no playing up or playing down, and you're going to play a wide range of opponents. But if it's these like continental chess style tournaments with rating delineations every 200 points, then yeah, that's where I would say play up some, but not too much. So you mentioned before we started recording, you're playing in Foxwoods Open, one of these big aforementioned Continental Chess Open tournaments coming up. To what extent is your play sort of local as compared to these big meat grinder tournaments?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think lately I've been playing kind of less like local events. I don't know, just because somehow, like, I don't know, I guess I just haven't had the chance to as much. But yeah, I always have kind of looked at these like bigger tournaments as being like, somehow like those are really the places where I get to like test myself. But yeah, I do play quite a bit in club tournaments too. Like I just finished this weekly tournament at the New Britain Chess Club, the club championship, which I tied for first in, which I was very very happy about.
Congrats. And what's the local competition like for you?
It's pretty good. I think I was the highest rated player in that tournament, but there were a couple other masters. If I want to play higher rated players, it's not so easy anymore.
Yeah. You're getting like, to that exact point where, it's harder to play local.
I mean, even also when I play in like these open tournaments, it's like I could play in like a CCA tournament and I could play all lower rated players every single round, which is a bit disappointing, especially if I like draw or lose in round one or two, which tends to happen, then it's like, well, I'm stuck playing lower rated players for the entire tournament. And, rating is definitely not going to, not going to increase much from that one.
That sounds all too familiar, Jordan.
Yeah.
And And to bounce another sort of debated topic from my book off of you, and Eugene perhaps has informed your perspective on this, what has your approach to end games been, Jordan? Did you study them separately or take them as they come?
I definitely have studied them separately. I actually think that endgames are very important. So I did actually read a little bit of that section in your book.
Here comes the fire. I'm ready.
No. Honestly, I don't remember exactly the details, but I think I generally agreed.
Okay. I concluded that you shouldn't overdo the technical endgames, especially like past, like you should learn the basics like Lucina and Philidor up to maybe 1500 level in Jeremy Soman's endgame course. But from there, I advocated more of a experiential approach.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's also what I would advocate. But I do think that studying the endgame and playing it, learning to play it well, I think is very important if you want to improve, because I think not only does it help you have better results in the endgame, but it also gives you kind of this confidence that you can win even if the pieces get traded off the board. So that was actually something that I noticed in my play, like after I first started making these making conscious efforts to study the endgame, was actually I was noticing opportunities where I could trade into like maybe an advantageous endgame, right? Whereas before I probably would have played like some other move, which maybe would have been good, but like it would have kind of kept more like complications on the board.
Right.
And you know, maybe I would have like messed things up later. I think it's not just about having better results in the endgame, it's about having the confidence to actually go for endgames, and also have the confidence that like you can play like 50 moves of an equal endgame without blundering.
Yeah.
Like that's actually something that's, I think, pretty important to have that confidence, because I remember like I used to get like very nervous, I think, just nervous for basically no reason, that I would just like blunder something in an equal
endgame. In endgames in particular.
Yeah.
Okay. And have nerves been an issue for you generally playing?
I wouldn't say so lately. That was kind of like the early days of my return, I would say.
Okay.
Actually, I'll add another story to the endgame study, which is like I clearly remember this tournament where it was a 5-round tournament, I think in Hartford, Connecticut. And I think I don't remember which section it was. It was like under 2100 or something. And, but anyway, my last two games were draws against higher rated players. And I was like winning in both of them. And both of them, I messed up a winning rook endgame.
Okay.
And it was like almost exactly the same kind of theme. Like basically in both of them, I kind of remember the theme was essentially that I let the opposing king like blockade one of my pass pawns, and that kind of caused me to mess up both of them. And so after that tournament I was like, okay, this is enough. I'm done with with this. I gotta actually work on end games at this point. And
okay.
What were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say, not to toot my own horn, but that's sort of what I say in the book, is that like if you are playing a lot and trying to learn from the games, you will reach a point where you have lessons like that. And then you're like, all right, I have to do end games. And you'll feel very driven, because, you know, you'll have the mark of, man, I really hate screwing up these games. whereas otherwise it just feels like kind of abstract, you know, even though it's technically supposed to be like a practical thing to memorize these end games. If it hasn't happened in a game, I find it more abstract. Sorry, did you have something to add to that? Because I have another question for you, if not.
Actually, I just another funny little thing that I remembered, which is that I kind of, for a while, I felt like I was not really very good at the end game. But then in one of my first lessons with Eugene, I remember he said, He looked at a couple of my games and he was like, "You're a great endgame player."
Oh, nice.
I was like, "Wait, what?" but actually, I think somehow like having that, even just like hearing him say that, I don't know, it almost like,
especially because he's Ukrainian, you know, like
come true kind of.
Anyone like, from the Soviet school compliments your endgames, that's like a huge feather in your cap. And I do, you know, considering the stories Eugene's told on the pod about working with like Yusupov and Dorfman and so on, like, you know, him complimenting your endgame is the highest praise.
Yeah.
Shout out to Eugene. And that actually was going to be the next topic I wanted to get into is what are the nature of your lessons with Eugene Perlstein, your coach?
Mostly we'll go over my games. So I would say I've been meeting with him for like for the last, I don't know, 2 years or so. I think I was around 2000 USCF when I started with him. And usually we just meet like, let's say once every other month or once a month. Basically whenever I play like a big tournament, and I have some games that I feel like would be interesting to go over with him, then I send him a message and we schedule a lesson. So mostly it's going over those games. And then also, you know, he will give me, some helpful advice on the openings, and he might show me like some maybe one of his games that applies, or maybe like a game in the database in the opening that we're talking about. But yeah, for the most part, it's going over my games. And I have to say that like it's definitely been very helpful. And definitely some of the things that have probably been the most helpful are just like these kind of offhand comments that he might make. So I want to say I definitely recommend like getting a coach if you don't have one, or just like maybe just scheduling like one lesson, because you never know what someone could say about your game that might just like make a big impact on you. Like, for example, I remember one thing he told me which I think helped me a lot, it was that when I have a better position, I should just play the simplest possible move. You know, depending on, I mean, of course, it depends on the type of advantage that you have. But there was this tournament that I had kind of two games where I was like slightly better. I sort of outplayed my opponents. Like I had in one of them, I was playing against like an isolated queen pawn or something. And in the other one, I was playing against hanging pawns. And in both of them, I sort of messed up the advantage, and I think both the games ended in draws. And I remember the second one, it was like this. So I was playing against the hanging pawns, and I had this opportunity at some point to just like kind of trade rooks, and like I could bring my other rook into the game with tempo, and like that was a very simple way to play. But instead, I chose this move, which like set a very devious trap, like against one of my opponent's natural moves. Like I was calculating this long line where I'd sack my queen and I would have this like winning attack with the back rank problems for her. But somehow, I mean, of course, like she was never going to fall for that, because it's like it's just one trap. It wasn't super obvious, but like there were other moves that were sort of more natural. And yeah, he was just like, "Why are you doing that?" Right? Like, right. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, you should just play the simple move. Right. And then like, it's difficult for the opponent to defend that type of position. And so that was kind of something that really sticks out in my mind as being like, just very, very helpful advice.
Yeah. Well said. And I think also, some people might feel like it's kind of like an all or nothing thing to have a coach, you know, like you either have to commit both financially and logistically to doing it every week. But I think there is a lot to be said for what you're doing. I mean, also you're playing a lot of serious games, but to mainly have someone that you can bounce ideas off of, like when you have questions from your serious games, especially as obviously you get to be stronger as you are, like, you know, you can be more targeted in how you use a coach than players earlier in their journey might be, but definitely. Yeah. I echo your general recommendation. And as I've told you, Gene, I'm a big fan of his Hyper-Accelerated Dragon course on Chessable. And he's quite knowledgeable about a handful of openings in particular, although obviously a player like him is helpful in any opening. But so is he like feeding you specific lines? I mean, you can pun on this if you want, but are you guys doing much opening work like from repertoires that he might advise you on, or is it more just sort of troubleshooting your game?
Yeah, it's both. He definitely has sent me some files, and I might incorporate them, or I might not necessarily. Like I might not actually play everything that he sends me. Some things I just think, okay, like I don't really like this as much. But yeah, for the most part, it's very, very helpful. Definitely.
Nice. We'll be back in a minute with more from Natasha and Matt. And we are back. And so, Jordan, you became a national master this year. For listeners outside of the United States, you probably still know this, but basically it's a domestic title if you reach a USCF rating of 2200, which puts you comfortably in like the 98th percentile of tournament chess players. But nonetheless, there's no norms or anything like that. So, it's not on the same level as like FIDE Master or obviously IM or GM. So I'm curious, Jordan, like as you were starting to get closer to 2200, like how big a point of emphasis was it for you to get those letters in front of your name?
It was pretty important. I was definitely very happy when I got it. Although I think I wasn't like super, super obsessed with it because I kind of had the attitude that like, okay, if I don't get it, I was never really worried about like falling back and like never reaching it basically. Like, I kind of had the attitude that like, I'll probably get it at some point. And so I didn't really need to like really stress too much about it. But yeah.
That's okay. What I would say. And you didn't feel like there was any particular breakthrough necessary, like to go from say 20, I mean, you're closer to 2300 now. So say from 2100 to almost 2300.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, actually, yeah, I actually had a couple months ago, I had a very, very good month where this was after I had already crossed 2200, but then I sunk down, I think, after one or two more tournaments, like 2190 something. And then I had a month where I gained like 80 or something points in like 1 month, which was really, 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 really great. And I shot all the way up to like 2286, I think it was. I think I played... trying to remember which month that actually was. It might have been when I played US Masters, partly because that was a really, really good tournament for me. And I definitely really enjoyed playing that. That was the first time I got to play that tournament.
Okay. And obviously, traveling to something like the USCF Masters, even Foxwoods, which is relatively local for you, but I'm guessing you still have to get a hotel, right?
Yeah, I'm still going to get a hotel there.
Yeah. So obviously, the costs add up. Like, how do you... how do you frame that in your mind?
Yeah, it's tough.
and luckily, your wallet.
Yeah. Luckily for some of these tournaments, my dad does help me. But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely just very grateful to the help and support that I get from my dad.
Yeah.
Also because not only just for paying for some of these things, but also like he actually founded, the chess club in Hamden, Connecticut, which is where I am. And, he's basically just provided that structure where, most of my students actually come through the chess club. So they find out about me through that. And, that's been really, really helpful.
That's great. Yeah. And so you're doing more lessons in person than on Zoom or whatever?
I would say it's about half and half. Okay. I mean, some of them find it through the chess club, but then also still want to do online lessons.
Okay. And are you taking students if anyone's interested?
I am. Yeah. I am taking students. You could probably, the easiest way to reach out is on LeeChess.
So I'll link to your secret LeeChess account.
No. Well, it's public LeeChess account.
Okay. Just kidding. Yeah. Given our earlier conversation about practicing openings. Yeah. I'll link to whichever account you tell me to. Last major topic, Jordan. So we touched on this a little in some emails we shot back and forth. But so you're on an amazing trajectory. I mean, it's really pretty unusual to jump up the way you have in these past few years. Are you do you have specific goals in mind in terms of next titles, and how much does that contribute to your daily practice?
I don't really have any very specific goals, I would say. I am looking to hopefully at some point reach an FM title or maybe even an IM title. But honestly, it's so far away in terms of my FIDE rating at this point that it's not really something I'm thinking too much about. It's more like a long-term goal.
Okay.
Because actually my FIDE rating has always been very, very low compared to my USCF rating. Only recently it got above 2000, just in time for the FIDE rating boost to everybody rated below 2000. Right.
Yeah. So you don't get any points.
Yeah. So I didn't get any points for that.
Yeah.
It's still gonna hopefully help with more points being in the system.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I used to be 2200 FIDE. Then I was about 2100, which I felt was closer to accurate. And then pandemic, playing people like you, my FIDE rating eventually got to below 2000. So I fell far enough where I got those 40 points, and now I'm back up to close to 2000. But to your broader point, it used to be that you could somewhat reliably count on USCF ratings, at least once they got to be about 2000, there would be maybe a 100-point gap with USCF generally being higher. But yeah, now it's just all over the place, and often it's hundreds of points. So it's hard to know. I mean, and things will change now in view of this FIDE change. And I know USCF has made a small change where there's additional bonus points for outlier performances in individual events, but they haven't made a change on the scale of FIDE. But it's a moving target, but hopefully at least small changes are starting to be made. Not the most important thing in the world in any event. So in closing, Jordan, for anyone listening who might feel stuck, feel like they're at a plateau, what advice would you give?
I would just say, try to actually go through, really do go through your own games. You want to look for what sort of patterns of mistakes are you making? And also one other thing that I think, that I didn't really get to talk too much about, but also really think about the psychology behind the mistakes that you make too when you review your games. Yeah. So it's good to do it relatively soon after you've actually played the game, so you can actually remember what you were thinking. And you really want to try to get into that question of why did you make the mistake, right? Were you thinking that, were you just not paying attention? Were you just thinking that you're winning and then all of a sudden you're not winning anymore and you didn't really readjust or whatever it is, right? Usually there's some kind of pattern there that I think you can, identify. So that's what I would recommend. And also for that, probably a coach or someone. It doesn't have to be a coach, but if you review your games with a friend too, sometimes they could maybe point out stuff that you're doing that seems a little bit strange. So
that's an extremely important point. So Jordan, I'm working on a Chessable course about critical moments. It's basically, so the audience is roughly 1,000 to 1,500, something like that, and I'm trying to isolate moments where either someone missed a knockout blow or they made like a, you know, bone-crushing mistake, soul-crushing mistake sort of thing. And I'm mainly relying on like databases to find amateur games for the positions, but I've also, it's forced me to go through my own games because those are the best examples if you can find the one. And I found several, and I have to say, Jordan, like all of the mistakes I found that I made, they're really not chess mistakes. They're like emotional mistakes. You know, yeah. as you go and you look at the games and you're like, yeah, at this moment I was, you know, such and such has happened and I was feeling such and such. So I just did this, you know? And it's like, I used to be a professional poker player, which is a job that requires a lot of emotional control. So to the extent that I have strengths and weaknesses in chess, I've always considered emotional control to be one of my strengths. But it's still right there, you know, it's all there when you look at the games. And so I definitely just wanted to reinforce that point, that the psychological side is not to be underestimated and coaches can be very helpful with that. One other thing I forgot to ask you, Jordan, is if you have any favorite resources to recommend for people, that's the things that helped you the most along the way that haven't been mentioned yet.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I could mention a couple of the books that I've liked. So I think when I was starting out, I read Silman's books, like the Reassess Your Chess and the Endgame book. And I didn't read The Amateur's Mind, but I have heard that it's really, really good. I've sort of skimmed through it since then. And I think that's also really good. So yeah, Jeremy Silman. I also recently read Under the Surface by Jan Marcos. I think that one was really, really good. And I also read The Seven Deadly Chess Sins recently by Rowson. And I think both of those were just excellent. Like, honestly, once I started, I like kind of couldn't put them down.
Yeah.
They were just so interesting.
You've got good taste. But I would definitely, for listeners, say the Silman books are, you know, you can Reassess Your Chess goes up to a high level. Some people, that can be overlooked by some people. But, you know, Sagar Shah said it helped him get to IM. Cyrus said Silman's books helped his game. Cyrus Lakdawala. You can start with Silman's books, you know, 1400, 1500, Amateur's Mind, maybe even a bit below then, and certainly Endgame, Silman's Endgame course before then. But I did just want to highlight that Seven Deadly Chess Sins, I think around 1600, 1700 is the lowest where you should consider reading it. And Under the Surface, it's a beautiful, poetic book, fascinating, but it's the chess material is quite advanced.
Yeah, it was interesting, actually. I kind of like thought of that book as I was reading it as like, this is like master level Reassess Your Chess. Reassess Your Chess, but for masters.
Yeah, that's beautifully encapsulated. All right. Well, Jordan, really appreciate your taking the time. So I will link to all your secret accounts for people to to look you up. Anything else before we say goodbye?
Nothing that I can really think of. I just want to thank you. It was great. I didn't even really notice that we were already up to an hour, however long.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Time flies when you're talking chess. All right. Yeah. Well, hope to meet you in person and wish you continued success on in your chess grind.
All right. Thank you very much.
Podcast Network.